skirt selectivity and intermodulation, third order intermodulation distortion. We don't get into that jazz. We use a piece of equipment and then and our buddies say, hey, it sounds good, and it's an oldie but goodie. It's something that's got a good track record. We get on and tell people about it. That's sort of the level of our operation here. It's a left-handed compliment, Mel, that they think you and I are getting together periodically at our great big laboratory. It's a one-acre laboratory, by the way, which has got a couple of $1 million worth of test equipment. I'm making up a story here. The only guy who comes close to that is Eric. He's got a laboratory. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Well, you're making a joke out of it, but this is what I'm getting here, Dick. They want us to, they want to send product leases in, and we should basically review, take the product either apart and look it over, you know, and review whether it's, you know, feasible to put it out on the market as is, or what we would suggest should be done to this product to improve it. I've gotten a number of them. It seems that I tried to, you know, email back to them that you did have your own, you know, product manufacturing facility of antennas, which had, I don't know if you're still operating K2RIW products, but we don't, you know, we didn't really get into that aspect of, you know, of actually, like you say, doing laboratory work and actually answering the question whether the piece of equipment, if we could critique it, and also, you know, before it goes on the market, what we would suggest. That's what some of these seem to boil down to, Dick, over.
Okay, stand by a second. Somebody called me on the input. Who was that? Okay, that's Charlie, WA2HMM. I'm hearing him on the input, and you're not coming through the machine. Either you're not giving the machine enough power, Charlie, or you don't have your PL oscillator turned on to 4Z. Do you normally get into the Limoc repeater from your Smithtown QTH, Charlie? Go ahead. You're good and loud on the input at my house. Charlie is WA2HMM. He and I go to the same QTH. Go to the same salt mine. And sounding good and loud on my input, but he's going to have to move a little bit, I think, to get through the machine. Or he's going to have to use his rooftop antenna. He's using his mobile rig right now, I believe. And Charlie was telling me that this great big laboratory that this mythical laboratory that Mel and I are talking about, Charlie is saying it should be spelled Lima Alpha Victor, not Lima Alpha Bravo. Okay. Call it what you like. But we don't have that much test equipment. We don't do evaluations of people's equipment. So it's a left-handed compliment that people think we can tell them a tune of 375. Well, that's right, yes. Hey, Charlie, if you go into 147.375 with your PL tone turned on, which is a lot closer to your QTH, you'll be able to get through this machine and talk to us. And I'll stand by after Mel makes his next transmission. We'll stand by and see if you want to come in and say something. Back to you, Mel, and I guess it's time to start off with mailbag unit email number one. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Me now, Dick?
Yeah, you sound good, Charlie. Like now. WA2HMM, you've got the floor if you want to say something.
I didn't realize that this was the magic frequency. Okay, I'll put it into memory here. I just thought I'd come in and harass you. We've been copying you on and off here. We've been riding all over the place here with Mama in the car, doing some shopping, eating out at J&R Steakhouse, all that good stuff. So hello to everybody on the frequency who might still be here. Matt, Dick. Dick will definitely see you tomorrow. WA2HM at Mobile in Smithtown, Long Island, New York.
Yeah, it turns out that as of late, Charlie, KE2EJ and WA2CDL have created a much tighter coupling between the 147.375 machine and the 146.85 machine. So during significant portions of the day and during certain nets, the audio from both machines are linked together. So since you're closer to the so-called eastern input, which is at the Adirondack Drive, you'll have a lot better coverage from Smithtown than all the way over to Lake, all the way over to Glen Oak. Guess we're ready for the first email, Mel. And if I know you, it might be an antenna question. K2KEY, K2RIW.
No, actually, I'm skipping over some of the antenna questions. They're very redundant, and I should say you could also always go to hamradio.tv and listen to the discussions on a number of these questions on antennas. So I just want to look for something a little different here. I specifically look for questions from young people because if they show an interest in any of this things that we talk about and have a little bit of a problem, I'd like to, you know, really help them so that they can keep their interest in, you know, keen interest into this, whatever you want to call this business. Sometimes I think it's a mishmash, like you say. Maybe that's really sometimes should work in the LAP. That's a good one, Charlie. Thank you. Here's one. I'm reading them over. Again, let me put it this way. These are spontaneous. Vic does, and I do not sit down and discuss these things beforehand. Many of these are just the first time I'm looking at them, really. I'm taking them and just thumbing through them now, and this is the first time I've looked at this particular one and most all of them, and I'm sure Vic is also the first time he's going to hear this. So if we do make little different changes or errors and all, please bear with us. We'll try to do our best. Let me let it drop.
Yeah, I've got a quick comment on this one, and that is what Mel and I are doing is what the broadcasters would call prime time live. there's a number of programs that claim that they're live. What you're hearing is live. Most of this is not canned. One other thing I wanted to mention before we get started on your first email is that anybody who can get a hold of Electronic Design Magazine, you will be interested in the June 26th issue, 2008. June 26th, which is called Volume 56, Number 13. I think it's a biweekly. The editorial page, Editor-in-Chief Joe Disposito, has a very nice article about photovoltaics. And the main thing that Joe is saying in that magazine, Electronic Design Magazine, is he's reporting on what he feels is the latest and the greatest. Let me drop. And that is a particular major company in the United States used to produce 1 million watts worth of solar voltaics per year. They're now producing 100 million watts per year. In 1995, solar voltaics installed on your property or at your factory used to be 70 cents a kilowatt. It's now down to 30 cents a kilowatt, and it's starting to become very interesting. Turns out that in California during prime time, a significant number of companies are paying between 20 and 30 cents a kilowatt hour for the electricity they use. $100 billion per year is spent on electricity in the United States between 20 and 30 cents per kilowatt hour. So photovoltaics now, with the price of installation, manufacturing, installation, wiring, the whole rigmarole, is now sitting at 30 cents a kilowatt, 30 cents a kilowatt hour, they call it. It's really 30 cents a kilowatt as I see it. And they think they're going to be down to 20 cents a kilowatt in the next couple of years. So we're getting to the point now where photovoltaic energy, renewable source, green energy, is now at the price of prime time power energy in in the costly areas like California, and we're rapidly getting to the point where photovoltaic will be at the same price as the average citizen is paying for electricity. And we've heard that PBS program where in Germany they are guaranteeing their citizens for the next 20 years that they will pay the citizen 50 cents a kilowatt hour for every kilowatt that you pump back into the power line in Germany. And as such, people are buying land on the Autobahn and putting photovoltaics on it because it wasn't being used for anything else. Land alongside of the, you know, the empty land alongside of the Autobahn. And people are putting wind and solar and other kinds of generators on their house, on their property, on their farm. And it's real incentive there. And we've got to do something about energy independence, because we're starting to complain about the price of oil and the price of gasoline. However, let me drop one more thing I'm going to tell you. There was a very nice article that was on National Public Radio 3 or 4 days ago. And the story was a guy who bought one of the premium, top-of-the-line SUV vehicles in the United States, and he paid 70 grand for it. He's now paying $4.30 per gallon for gas. It really bugs the daylights out of him. So he said, gee, I want to sell my SUV. And he went from dealer to dealer to dealer, and a one-year-old SUV with something like 8,000 miles on it, he's only able to get $30,000 for it. He paid 70, and he can only get 30 when he sells it 1 year later, because nobody wants SUVs. He's taking a $40,000 hit if he sold it, and he's strongly motivated to sell it because of the price of gas. Well, the person writing the article on NPR said, hey, look at this realistically. The guy probably doesn't even come close to using 1,000 gallons of gas per year. He was happy paying $3.20 a gallon when he bought the vehicle. He's now paying $4.20 a gallon. That's $1 more per gallon. And he only uses $1,000 per year. So his total delta for the gasoline to run that vehicle for a year is $1,000. It's very unreasonable to try to sell a vehicle and lose $40,000 when the difference is only $1,000 per year for the actual price of gas. And they went further in the article to say that everything that we're using these days, food, rent, gasoline, tolls, airfares, everything has gone up faster than the price of gasoline has increased. And most of the other things, we grumble about it, but we tolerate it. It's just something peculiar about gasoline that every nickel it rises, we bitch and moan about it. You got to look at the big picture. To sell a $70,000 vehicle at a $40,000 loss to save $1,000 a year is very poor economics. But still, because of this article, I'm seeing light at the end of the tunnel, sunlight, where hopefully we will all be using more renewable energy. And one last thing I want to mention on this one. There are people who look at fuel cells and say they're great. There are people who look at them. Plug-in battery cars and say they're great. I'm not so convinced, because a plug-in battery car for making short trips, yeah, you're not burning gas, you're not making exhaust pipe effluent and pollution when you run that vehicle. That's the good news. But still, where does the energy come from when you plug that thing to charge it? It's coming from your local power station, which is either burning oil or coal. So the raw energy is still coming from coal, and it still makes us vulnerable to importing the 60% of the oil that we're importing. We really got to get ourselves out from all of this importing, which is creating this vulnerability. And so we've got to start thinking real hard about renewable energy resources. We've got to really allow drilling in all the places where we're allowed to drill. We've got to allow more refineries to be built. And we got to start thinking stronger about photovoltaics and wind and all the other kinds of renewables. Because the price of oil is going to continue to increase. It's not going to go back down. It's going to continue to increase. We've got 1 million people in India, for instance, and a couple of 1 billion people in China who want to live the same way the Americans do. They feel that they're entitled. They're going to need the same kind of energy we do. They're going to be demanding the same oil, and the price is going to continue to increase. That's an opinion. K2KEY, K2LAW.
KC2QAQ?
KEY, no doubt. The problem is, of course, in this country, is permits and things, and not my backyard routine. So you're going to have that as you do about the debacle with that business of trying to put windmills off the coast of Long Island and what happened with that. And similar incidents here in the five boroughs when they wanted to put a, for instance, a gas, a natural gas-driven substation here to generate electric to help out, you know, with these brownouts and areas that are overtaxed electric. You don't know what went on. No, you're not putting that thing in my backyard with that electromagnetic waves and all kinds of things be going on. So there you are. It's maybe an easier sell somewhere else, but this country is difficult. Now, as far as these vehicles, somebody buys a $70,000 vehicle initially, I don't think you'll worry if gasoline is $10 a gallon from what I heard with the interview. They interviewed a guy that had a $250,000 automobile, and he was saying that he wishes gasoline would be $20 a gallon because it wouldn't have any effect on him financially, but he'd have a lot more of the open road to drive because they'll let people be on the road. Over.
That's a good way to look at it. Glenn broke in. He wanted to say something, and I bet you got some opinions about the photovoltaics, Glenn, because you built some of these fancy power supplies. And I didn't complete my statement about fuel cells. Fuel cells run on hydrogen and oxygen. So where do you get the hydrogen and oxygen from? By electrolyzing water. Where does the energy come from to electrolyze the water? From the local power station. AC2QIQ, you got it, Glenn.
Oh, you're absolutely correct, Dick. Dick, I think last time we were talking about fuel cells, I was just talking about space applications where, you know, versus batteries and things, but... actually, one thing I wanted to bring up is, I think I mentioned it last week, was LIFE is offering a solar pioneer program where, with this program, basically they'll set you up with solar voltaics on your house and supplement your bill. I was wondering, have you looked at that website yet?
No, I haven't. And tell us all the website address we should go to. So I think you're saying that LIFE is supplying the incentive, which is a little bit further down range than I think it should be. I think our state or federal government should be supplying the incentive. From my point of view, that system they've got in Germany is working very well. I mean, we got the choice of either taking a couple of billion dollars from the federal government and investing it into photovoltaic research to make the cells themselves cheaper, because it's only a fabrication problem. The raw ingredients, the sand, the silicon, is not expensive. And they're getting cheaper and cheaper as time goes on because people are discovering the way to do it. But you wouldn't have to worry about funding it with the federal government and waiting X number of years to get the results if you apply the immediate result technique that Germany's doing. If you get a whole lot of people doing it because they're getting 50 cents a kilowatt hour for what they pump back, wow, all of a sudden they're going to find lots of places to do it. I'll admit that that subsidy costs something. Everybody's going to have to pay a little bit in the process, but that's going to really move the program along, as I see it. You got it, Glenn.
Well, I with questions.
Joe recognized, but Glenn first. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. I believe this has also got the endorsement, if not probably some monetary backing, of New York State as well. The website is www.lipwer.org/efficiency/solar/HTML.
So, lipwer.org/efficiency/HTML. Did I got that right?
Right after efficiency, then it's solar.html.
Solar dot or solar slash?
Solar dot.
Okay, so WIPWER, Lima, India, Papa, Whiskey, Echo, Romeo, .org/efficiency.solar.html, if I got that right.
Sufficiency solar.html.
No efficient, no punctuation between efficiency and solar?
Just the forward switch.
Okay, so slash efficiency slash solar dot HTML, if I got it right.
That should be it. And when you look at that website, it gives you a download for a Solar Pioneers brochure, which I think gives you some pricing and some basic setups with the control systems that you can not only supply your power, but also sell it back to LIPA, I guess, through a New York State-endorsed program.
Now, the one thing that bothers me about this system is that when you install solar voltaics on your property, at your house, in most communities, I believe your assessed valuation will increase. You're going to pay more taxes. My goodness, is that a counterincentive? I wonder if that's mentioned at all in this package, Glenn. Go ahead.
I guess, Dick, that's one of the reasons why I'm throwing it at you. If you notice, I haven't jumped on it yet myself, although I'd love to. But I'd like to throw it out to just other people and see what other people think, and maybe we have enough brains to put together here in the club and see whether this is something that maybe we can say is thumbs up or thumbs down kind of a thing.
But our need for energy is now becoming so significant. From my point of view, we are spilling American blood in the Near East, protecting that source of oil so that we don't all have to sit on gas lines like we did in the so-called oil embargo of 1972. So because of our vulnerability of importing oil, we have this vulnerability problem. Solar voltaics is one of the best choices to start solving the problem, and as such, anything you add to a house that increases its value, you tend to get taxed on it. I think they should make an exception because this is something that is almost related to homeland security from my point of view. I see a relationship between Department of Homeland Security and the the reliability of the oil flow into this country. If that oil doesn't flow at exactly the right rate, and hopefully the right number of dollars of cash flow, we all suffer. Our economy goes down something fast, our food gets expensive, all kinds of nasty things happen. As such, the real incentive should be our government, whether it be either one of our presidential candidates. I wish they would set a law saying that because of the need for energy, and because of the criticalness and how it indirectly relates to homeland security, that there should be an exception that no matter how many solar voltaics you put on your property, within reason, it doesn't increase your assessed valuation. That seems to make so much sense to me. I'm unhappy that someone hasn't been saying that and blazing it across the newspapers already. Anybody with any further opinions on this, give Mel and me a call. It is K2RIW.
Okay, here you go.
Eric, recognize? Anyone else?
K2KEY. I'll tell you what's happening in Jersey.
Okay. Eric first, and then Mel. Eric, you pass it over to Mel when you're through. You got it, Eric.
I had a couple of things. The LIPA setup, they'll give you... I don't remember exactly what they pay you. They give you a reasonable rebate for putting in a solar system, but there's a caveat with that, and that is you cannot... you know, install batteries with it. They won't have anything to do with you if you think that you want to completely disconnect from the grid. So that's one thing. New Jersey's been doing it for a couple of years now. As far as the assessment of the house with solar power, I haven't seen anything. I've been looking, and I haven't heard anything. I'm, you know, pretty much connected with it because... we have a couple of friends who are in the business, and we're doing some of our own experimentation. As far as manufacturing goes, one of the things about Germany that's made it so efficient is that not only do they do their own manufacturing, but they do their own mining and preparation of material. Whereas one of the biggest arguments worldwide why there is such a shortage of solar panels, and if you go try and buy some, you'll find out that, that they're hard to get. And that is because of the corporate interest of the chemical companies that make the raw material for solar panels get more money for more refined materials for use in semiconductors than they do for solar panels. Go ahead, Mel.
Exactly. I was just going to say that same thing, Eric. They said it's more money-wise that they're, however they, you know, sell these blanks, they call them. I've got these discs, you know, these silicon discs. They have to have a name for it when they process it for these discs. And they found, of course, that the semiconductor manufacturers will buy this disc will wind up giving them more for this than they would get it out of, you know, using them in solar panels. So it's more profitable, basically. But I was going to say, my daughter was telling me, I think she did, I don't remember if she said it was Jersey somewhere or out in Pennsylvania. I thought she maybe mentioned a friend, Jersey or Pennsylvania, that if you put it on a private house, there is a commercial, now you get into a commercial situation because you're becoming now, you're taking a private property and you're turning into a commercial entity, in other words, a commercial business of sorts, Dick, and there's a surcharge over.
Yeah, I don't like it. The tax situation is a really nasty one because once your assessed valuation goes up, you're going to pay increased taxes every year for the next zillion years. And the fact that nobody has yet had an increase in their assessment because of the solar voltaics added to the house doesn't mean it's not a rule that's on the books. It just means that they haven't announced it to their local zoning board or their local building department. Lots of people will, for instance, install an air conditioner at their house, and if the building department doesn't find out about it, it doesn't increase the assessed valuation. But in theory, the house is now more valuable. So there are people who get increased in taxes because they've added central air conditioning. And so by the same token, if your building department and tax assessing department knew about it of your particular town, I think they would increase the assessed valuation because of the solar voltaics. There's got to be a dispensation, a relaxation, or a release on that particular one, in my opinion. You might have some opinions on this one, Eric. KE2EJ, KQLAW.
QGZ.
All right, Dick.
Well, I'd say pretty abreast of things. By the way, the latest improvement in solar voltaics is by mounting the substrate on a heat sink and using these double convex lenses in front of it to concentrate the energy and using materials that withstand higher temperatures. So this is the newer technology. They find that they can produce more than twice the amount of energy in the same, using basically the same material, but just by restructuring it this way. Makes it a little bit more expensive because of the heat-sinking materials and also the glass that's involved. But that technology is actually being developed. It was originally tried by MIT. It's now being turned into an actual production system in Germany. And, of course, they're going to be the first ones to use it. But if you ever in Las Vegas and you want to see something like that that generates 80 kilowatts, in a very small space. University of Las Vegas and University of Nevada in Las Vegas and right on the back side of the Mac Center, they have a working system which also tracks the sun, of course, to make it more efficient. And they also have a direct mirror assembly which drives a Stirling engine. That thing generates, when it's running, they haven't had it running in a couple of years, but when that thing was running, it generates over 100 kilowatts of energy, and that's quite interesting. But don't forget that you're in the desert there, and the sun is shining an awful lot. KQRWKE2J, pick up the other station.
Yeah, Bill recognized. This German system you talked about that runs at higher temperature with lenses in front, could you also run your heating coils behind those solar cells and be heating your domestic water with the waste energy that didn't become part of the solar voltaic? Back to you, Eric.
Yeah, that's one of the plans, actually. They the heat sink material has piping in it, and you can run water or some other type of refrigerant through it.
Fantastic. Let's see what Bill's got to say. 782QGZ, you got it, Bill.
I can do this. W82QGZ. Yep, first order of business. Yeah, the issue with some of the rebates from LIPO, like Eric said, was if you start sticking in batteries and storage, they're not too interested in giving you a rebate. The rebates were reasonable. With regard to the property tax thing, I will cite as my source a brochure I got from a local place, which I have now run around and can't seem to find. But it indicated that there was a 15 or 20 year exemption from property tax increase or a reassessment because of the installation of the photovoltaic stuff. I'm not sure whether it's in all of New York State or just Nassau County. The place that I got the brochure from, they did an installation at a buddy's house. I think they're located at Seaford or Wantagh, and I got that information off the back of their brochure. So that's relatively recent. That thing's only a couple of weeks old, that brochure. So it seems like there may be at least a temporary 15 to 20 year exemption. Okay.
QQQIQ.
Glenn recognized. A quick question, Bill. Your buddy installed solar voltaics. Roughly how many kilowatts did he install?
His installation is actually not complete. I offhand, I don't know what he got. I wanted to go down and have a peek when they were putting it in, and then afterwards. I know that his is just, in other words, no storage, kind of like LIPO wants. But more to follow once he's all done. His installation is in progress.
Yeah, I can see some of the motivation for LIPO not wanting batteries, because that way, in theory, you become independent, but very few people can truly become thoroughly independent. Second of all, when you're pumping back to them would be during the time of high noon sun exposure. That's when people in the summertime are running their air conditioning, and that's when they need the extra power. So I can see why they'd like to get you to pump the power back at that time. QIQ, you've got it, Glenn.
Yes, Dick. I was just looking at New York State and their website, and they're showing what they call a New York State Energy Star rating for homes. And if your house is actually being powered where it's, quote-unquote, cooler in the summertime and warmer in the wintertime via alternate energy means, the house can actually get what they call a New York Energy Star rating. And then at that point, you have some kind of a tax exemption or a tax improvement. I don't know all the details on it. It's just something I browsed across while I was looking at some of these subjects right now on the Internet.
KA2SCS. Thank you, Glenn. Sounded like KA2SCS. Give us your call letters and name, sir, and go ahead with your comment.
Kilo Bravo 2, Sierra Charlie Sierra. John, how copy?
Pretty good, John. Go right ahead.
Good evening, Dick. I was watching on the, I think it was a Learning Channel, about this new solar panel type material that's a real thin material that's supposed to be a lot more efficient and so on and so forth. And just wondering if anybody else has heard about it and whatever happened to it, because I haven't heard anything about it since. And the way they were claiming this stuff is better than sliced bread.
Very fine, John. Yeah, your run-of-the-mill solar cells, I think, have a conversion efficiency of around 10%. The sun gives you something like 1,300 watts per square meter at high noon on a clear day when the panel is aimed directly at the sun. And 10% of that, or 130 watts, is what you get out of run-of-the-mill solar cells. There are exotic ones that go up to 30%, 32% being used by NASA. And I've seen an article by an experiment being run, I think it is not Stanford, but one of the Southern California universities is running a experiment on a slightly different technique for building silicon solar cells, and they're getting something like 40% efficiency. So when the fabrication problem is solved, and that's a matter of just applying enough brain power and research as I see it, solar cells are going to get cheaper and they're going to get more efficient. Now, the exact efficiency is not a tiebreaker as I see it. In other words, if the exotic cells are 40% and the really cheap cells are, let's say, 12%, and I've got enough area to put up enough of them, when it comes to the price of ownership, would you buy the expensive ones? Well, another one of the variables you'd have to worry about is what is their longevity. In the case of the solar cells that NASA puts in space, they do degrade a little bit as a function of ultraviolet exposure. Well, here on Earth, we don't get anywhere near as much ultraviolet exposure, so I'd like to believe that the life of the cells, properly treated here, not counting weather effects, could be pretty darn good. Those are some of my opinions. Anyone got any further questions or comments? Give me a call, it is K2RIW, the TechNet.
Okay, here you go.
Eric, go right ahead.
No, I just did a little clarifying. The incentive for New York State for residential customers to get a 25% tax credit and an incentive cap from New York State at $5,000. You also, Nassau County, Suffolk County, New York State, there's no sales tax. New York State has a 15-year real property tax exemption for New York State's real property tax laws for solar systems installed in New York State. So there you go on that. So the things that you're worrying about, you're not going to have to worry about for a while. And the federal government will give you up to 30% tax credit with a cap of $2,000 per photovoltaic. And LIPA will give you $3,750 per kilowatt of installed equipment pre-approved up to 10 kilowatts. So there you go. They have other plans for schools and stuff like that. And I also remember going back to what we were talking about earlier. I found something interesting about ABC and CBS. ABC wanted to go back to Channel 7, and they got a hard time from a New Jersey station. The New Jersey station wants to be on Channel 8, and they said, no, you can't do that, but it seems like ABC won that battle. And CBS also is getting some grief from Connecticut because they're going to take Channel 33. They're not going to go to Channel 2. So what's on 33 now is Channel 11. They're going to go back to Channel 11. So that's where the New York guys are. So ABC is going to be on 7. And this is the last, this is the fourth report in order from the FCC on the FCC website. That's what I'm putting here. It was, the FCC said that we conclude that the loss of service for ABC would affect the current view of ABC, while the predicted loss of service for WNJB would affect areas outside its current coverage area. They also note that WABC is a pioneer of digital service, having built full-power digital operation in 2001, built them at four times square than an empire, and with backup at Alpine. So, in contrast, WNJB had not built this digital facility and recently requested an extension of his SBA beyond July's first use or lose deadline. So they turned out to be the loser and ABC turned out to be the winner. And one more thing, and that is the solar cells that have the lenses on them run about 40 to 45% efficient. Current solar cells that we put on your house today are...
Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, we lost a little bit of the end of that one, Eric. I heard you on the input. First of all, it sounds like Channel 2 is going off the air on February 17, 2009. And nothing is replacing Channel 2, if I heard you correctly. Second of all, with those rebates that you get from LIPA, state, and federal, and the dispensation on taxation, you put that all together, wow, that sounds like some package if you're allowed to cascade them all. How soon are you going to put photovoltaics on your house, Eric? Go ahead.
No, I already have some, but, you know, I run my DC system from it, so I don't use it as a replacement for electricity yet. Not unless I finally get around to building the inverters that I want to build, because if you go out and you buy the inverters, they're not cheap. They're as expensive as the panels, and, I think I can build something better than that, but, who knows, maybe I'll be dead before I get to do that.
Now, Channel 2, CBS will be on Channel 33, which is currently occupied by WPIX. WPIX is going to go back to 11, and CBS will move from 56 to 33.
Okay, that sounds like Channel 2, 54 to 60 megacycles, will be unused, is what it sounds like. If that's true, the guys on 6 meters are going to be a little bit happier. What do you think?
Now, actually, the guys on 6 meters are going to be very happy after the digital transition, whether there's anything on Channel 2 or not, because the nature of the signal is just noise. So, you know, it's going to have less of an effect than, say, the harmonics coming from a picture carrier. But, yeah, that's the case. 54 out of 60 is going to be empty.
You think that'll go to two-way communication services eventually in metro areas?
Well, actually, the way the law is written right now, the public service that exists on Channel 16 and 17 and that area, that's going to stay. And the way the law is written, I don't see anybody climbing that up. I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, I'm still having trouble believing, though, that 54 to 60 will sit there unused for any length of time. You know, use it or lose it. Somebody's going to claim it. Somebody's going to take a claim, is my belief, when CBS goes off of 54 to 60. Anyone with any further questions or comments, give me your call letters right now. KQLIW.
You know, 54 to 60 is going to be used in about 20 places around the country, so it's not going to go away.
Do they sometimes make special rules, though, that if a particular metro area is not using it for broadcast, that it can be used for two-way communication? I think there's been a couple of exceptions like that on various channels. Hasn't there been?
Yeah, but that's in the UHF range, and that's been enforced for like 20 years.
Okay, so you're saying they don't do that in lower VHF. Or I guess you're saying they don't do it on the VHFs, they only do it on the UHFs, is what I think you're saying. Back to you, Eric.
Yeah, Roger. Well, you're going to find out that there used to be low band commercial radio. The police department used to be down in the 40s, and the fire department. Actually, there's still some fire departments, but everybody pretty much has vacated the low band because of the skip problems that they have. And everybody moved to trucking radio, 800 and up. So I don't think there's going to be any incentive for people to go back to 50 megahertz, that's for sure.
Well, hold on now. I've had a couple of conversations in the last couple of weeks with fire people who have told me that the 48 meg region is their most reliable radio. Yes, they get some band openings occasionally. It gives them some grief. And I think they got either 4 or 6 channels in the 48 meg region. But when it comes to reliable communication from the firehouse to the truck that's on a job, on a actual fire putting out job, the 48 megs gives them a hell of a lot more coverage. There are all kinds of horror stories of fire and police that go to 800 megs, and unless they put a zillion towers all over the town, they do not get the coverage because of foliage attenuation, because of terrain, hills and valleys and whatever. There's lots and lots of horror stories of companies that got talked into great sounding equipment up at 800 megs, digital and all kinds of whiz-bang connections and whatever, got capability, but the UHF at 800 megs just doesn't get through the trees unless you got a whole lot of towers scattered all over your particular town and county. You might have an opinion on that one, Eric. Go ahead.
No, I'm not going to argue with that. The big thing that got them to move beyond the technology and the sales pitches that Motorola and Johnson and a few others made was the fact that certain times of the year, the band opens, and it was quite, they decided to move when we were in the height of the sunspot cycle, which made communication for them in a lot of emergency situations completely impossible. So that was one of the reasons for vacating, but not the only one. Don't forget, when radio systems are bought by cities and towns, it's not bought by the people who actually have any technical input. It's usually bought by the accountants,
Oh boy, you hit that nail on the head. In the case of New Orleans, not only did they switch up to, I think it was 800 megs and had nowhere near the coverage they should have had, the backup power systems were not adequate, but the biggest mistake they made is to not spend a small number of dollars making sure that the policeman's handy-talkie radio could be recharged from the cigarette lighter of his patrol car. They did not buy those power supplies. Therefore, all the handy-talkies went dead. There was no power at the fire stations to recharge them. And so communications for that police department really went down the tubes, and a significant number of those officers vacated that town and vacated that state. They just couldn't tolerate the fact that they didn't have that radio to back them up. A policeman without a working radio is in an awful lot of trouble. He doesn't have the ability to say, officer being fired upon, I need backup. Without that radio link, he is beyond the end of his rope, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Eric.
Oh, so very true, Dick. Oh, so very true. Look, you know, when the World Trade Center went down, you know, what was up there? The entire New York State Police Network. A few other things. There was all this stuff that had really fancy radio systems that no longer worked because there was no truck master to instruct everything what to do.
Yep. Whoever did the planning on that one was a little bit short-sighted. I can see how everyone said, hey, there's nothing more stable than the World Trade Center, the World Trade Center. That's the Rock of Gibraltar. It's going to be here forever. That was the thinking. My goodness. A lot of our thinking has shifted since 9/11. Wow. And still, though, every administration that comes into a city, a town, a state, federal, Homeland Security, whatever, they all say the words, we're going to establish intercommunication between the emergency services. They all say those words. Falls off the tongue easily. You can write it in a report. It's easy to write. They don't do it. Can you imagine, you tell your particular police force that if you switch down to this particular channel, you'll be able to talk to that other emergency service, to which the chief of police will say, whoa, wait a minute now. Does that mean that some of my officers are going to switch to that channel by mistake and I can't talk to them anymore? How do you make sure that that doesn't goof me up? And as such, each service has their favorite frequencies, their favorite mode of operation, and they don't want to make a change. And to create the intercommunication in many cases sounds like too big a change. Have an opinion on that one, Eric?
Actually, I do, because I talk to these gentlemen that actually take care of, you even know a few of them, that it's their job to take care of police departments and fire departments. And they say the biggest problem with interoperability is that they just simply won't go there. They don't, the police don't want to talk to the fire don't want to talk to police. They want to go through some third party that, you know, is that they have control of. This whole business about what the 700 megahertz space with the public service in the middle of it being auctioned off, that's why television is all moving around. They have allocated space for the interoperable radio system. But hello, folks. Motorola's got this system. Johnson's got that one. This one's got that one. And, you know, until they write into the law that the interoperability has to be 5 kilohertz FM channel that any radio can decode or listen to, it's just going to be the same thing all over again at somebody else's expense.
Yeah, some of the really moderate Motorola radios have a mode of operation you can put it in where 5% of the time, once every 2 seconds or something like that, it'll hop over to an emergency channel that you designate, and it'll listen and find out if there's any activity there, and then hop back. So I see ways that you could establish a system where the system would allow you to break in to the communication system from an adjacent service, another emergency service, and maybe not be too much of an interference to the main operation of the service that particular fireman or that particular policeman is using. And maybe you've got an extra button you press on the side where if you're really hot and heavy into something and you don't want to hear that other service for this period of time, you press and hold that button. I think there are ways you could make it work. What do you think, Eric?
No, there's thousands of ways. We can move this stuff just the way it is, but the reality is when do you require that type of service, okay? You need an event, a major, major event, like a World Trade Center event. They don't happen too often. So life goes on living in the world that they live in without going outside the boundaries of their world, even though they may cross paths with one another. But as far as they're concerned, they're them and we're us. So until that mindset goes away, you have all the best technology in the world isn't going to make anything happen.
Okay, you've hit the nail on the head. It's a psychology and a people problem, and it's an us and them problem within each one of these services. They want their chief of police and their chief fire dispatcher to talk to them and no one else. Well, they don't want to talk to anyone else. That's where their chain of command comes from. That's where their training is emphasized. So this real interoperability that Homeland Security is talking about, it looks to me like it's going to be a sea change that's going to happen very slowly, and it's going to be a lot of shift in thinking. It's almost like trying to talk somebody into changing their religion. It's going to be tough. But those guys in Brooklyn, though, they've worked out the problem. K2KEY, Mel, how would you solve this one? K2LIW.
Yeah, I have the call if anything. This is K2KEY. All I could tell you is, here in Brooklyn, if you put a coat of paint sometimes on your house, you've got to be careful that it isn't recorded so that you get an increase in your taxes, because I've been going through hell here, because they've been putting up, they've been tearing down houses all around me, in fact. Coming down now on the block, there's maybe about four or five houses that are original, and the rest are all been torn out, and new ones have been put in there, and these mini mansions that they're putting in has created a situation here where it's pushing up and up the tax base here, and it's ridiculous. I don't know, they just don't seem to, you know, stop every year. It's another assessment for higher taxes, because they supposedly, I don't know if the house is really worth what they estimate, but this is what they feel it'll bring, because, you know, they feel that, like I say, with all the little mansions around me. Well, anything that you do to improve for anything around here winds up costing you out of your possible. A lot of it is very unreasonable at the rate of jumps being taken. That's what's going on here in my area. Shall we get to some emails, please?
I recommend we do. We've been discussing some good subjects, but let's pick up some emails.
Okay, very good. That's because it's getting late. We keep getting off. We started with emails a half hour or so ago, and no one went with it. All right, I'm trying to pick out ones. I read through a whole bunch of them here, and I guess I'm going to skip over some of the antenna ones here. They're redundant. You can go to hamradio.tv and listen to our talks on these antenna subjects again. But I got one here, see, from a person, and he says, a young person, he says, I'm looking to buy a transceiver, and I noticed that the ARRL does, does the lab report on a number of pieces of equipment. And one part of the lab report I don't quite really understand very much, because they never really explained it. What exactly is phase noise, P-H-A-S-E, phase noise? And what does that mean next to phase noise, DBC/Hertz? I guess he's referring to DB as far as the carrier, and for Hertz, Dick, I believe that's what the C stands for, DBC, when they do the phase noise measurement. But, okay, go ahead, explain phase noise a little bit, over.
Okay, this is not well understood by a lot of amateurs, and it's not well understood by a lot of engineers, a little bit on the complicated side. Back in the days when we used to use crystal oscillators for our rigs, the good news is you had a nice high-Q device called a quartz crystal that determined the frequency you're on. And you bought the right crystal, you put it into the right oscillator, you had a high-quality signal that operated the local oscillator of your mixer. but we all got tired real fast of buying zillions of crystals to go over all of our frequencies, and you never had the right crystal at the right time. So frequency synthesizers came along. The good news about a frequency synthesizer is you set the knob, so to speak, to the right click position, and you're on that frequency. You can decide what frequency you're going to be on. That's the good news. The bad news is that there are synthesizers and there are synthesizers. A frequency synthesizer of low quality is one where when you look at the local oscillator signal made by the frequency synthesizer on a good spectrum analyzer, instead of it looking like that crystal oscillator used to look, in other words, one simple vertical line in the middle of the screen and nothing else, you build an oscillator for 31 megacycles, and you look at it on a spectrum analyzer that scans DC to light, and you see a nice, clean signal at 31 megs and nothing else. Okay. But the way a frequency synthesizer works is it's got a voltage-controlled oscillator that when you make the voltage go up or down into the command port of an oscillator, the frequency goes up and down. That's the good news. You can tune it. That's what the synthesizer does. It gives a precise signal that tunes that oscillator to the frequency where you want to be. However, there's always some noise on that command. There's always some residual noise built into the oscillator itself. The net result is that when you look at it on a spectrum analyzer, instead of it being one nice vertical line, it now looks like a gentle hill. When you've got a skirt on the left side and a skirt on the right side of noise. If you dig into what's really going on, there is residual angular modulation taking place, whether it be noise on the command signal for the voltage-controlled oscillator or noise in the oscillator itself. There's lots of ways of having the problem go bad. There's very few ways you can get it just right. When you get it just right, a good synthesizer will give you a signal that is almost as clean. Let me drop. Almost as clean as what that quartz crystal oscillator used to be. But there are very few synthesizers are that good. That quartz crystal oscillator, the quartz crystal itself, in some cases, has a Q of 100,000. The voltage-controlled oscillator you're using has a Q of 100. And you want the electronics connected around it to try to, by way of feedback, measure the instantaneous frequency and tell the oscillator to go up or down and to keep it on just the right spot. The residual, I mean, if I took a oscillator and FM modulated it or phase modulated, I'd be making a sideband. If I whistled into the microphone of a phase modulated transmitter and it was narrowband modulation, I looked on a spectrum analyzer and I'm whistling into the microphone at a 1 kT note coming out of my mouth, I will on the spectrum analyzer see the carrier and I'll see a sideband 1 kT up and 1 kT down. Narrowband FM, that's what you would see. With wideband FM, you'd see more sideband. We won't go there right now. But if I made broadband noise with my mouth, instead of whistling, I go, I'm making broadband noise. On the spectrum analyzer, I would now see a not upper and lower sideband. I would see this hill effect again. In other words, the carrier is the peak of the hill, and then you would see these sidebands that are kind of fuzzy off to the right and to the left. Okay, how do you measure the quality of an oscillator? You tune a known number of hertz or kilohertz off to one side, and you measure how strong is those sidebands. Whether they be made by whistling or made by noise, doesn't matter. How strong is that sideband? If the oscillator was perfect, and you tune 3 kilohertz up and 3 kilohertz down, there should be nothing there. A low-quality oscillator might have noise power up there, 3 kilohertz up and 3 kilohertz down, that's only 20 dB weaker than the carrier. And if I was making that measurement with a 1 kilohertz resolution bandwidth, I would rate that noise power of 3 kilohertz away, and I would say that it's got the minus 20 dB C per 3 kilohertz. I'd use some not-so-good numbers here, but you see the point. When you're measuring noise power, you don't just measure power. You have to describe the bandwidth with which you measured that power. That's why it's dBc per hertz. It's per